Okay, it looks like we've got a good number of attendees. Let's begin. So first of all, thank you again for joining today's webinar. My name is Michelle Belorci, and I am joined with my colleague Carlene Velez. We are both located in the Washington, D.C. office of the Institute of International Education, and we are both outreach and recruitment specialists for the U.S. Scholar Program, specifically for these regions, South and Central Asia and East Asia and the Pacific. So the purpose of today's session is really to provide some useful tips and advise you, answer any of the questions that you have. We've got less than 4 weeks until the application deadline on September 16th. And so Carlene and I are here to address any questions you have, either with the awards or application process, the application form, things like that. So feel free to go ahead and type in your questions as they come up. We do have a few slides to go over in terms of how to submit a competitive application, but certainly we can take your questions as we go through as they're relevant. And again, I really want to devote the full hour today to addressing your concerns, any questions you have, and really kind of ensuring that you have a strong application come September 16. So let's begin. And starting out, the baseline eligibility for the program, for those of you that are new to this, it's U.S. citizenship is really the baseline eligibility. And then depending on the award, it will, you know, state whether a terminal degree or a PhD is required. Several awards are open to candidates that have a master's degree and several years of experience. But for those of you that are recent graduates or have recently that are currently in a master's program or currently in a PhD program at the start of the PhD program, you would probably be better served looking at the opportunities in the Fulbright student program. If you are looking at postdoc opportunities, however, you are in the right place. And again, in terms of other things required by the program, depending on the award, certain number of years of teaching experience, you know, years of experience outside of academia, if it's an award that's open to professionals. And then just in terms of eligibility, we certainly do encourage veterans, those that have served in the armed forces, to apply. And if you are a returning applicant, a returning grantee, I should say, if you've had a Fulbright Scholar grant in the past and you'd like to reapply, we do have policies on you know, the time frame you have to wait. So we ask for a 2-year waiting period between grants. And in the project statement, please add some justification as to why you are applying for a second grant. Okay, so really at the core of the process and really putting together a competitive application, people always ask us, how can I, you know, put my best foot forward and really put forward a strong application? And it actually starts with selecting the right award. Since you can only apply to one award, one grant opportunity, you really need to ensure that you are matching your experience and your expertise to what the award is seeking. Since we have over 450 awards, actually I think it's almost 470 at this point, we have several unique award opportunities that sometimes can read like a job description and others are quite open and very broad and allow the scholar to determine what they'd like to do on the grant. So it's important to find the right award. So things to consider would be any regional experience you have, your language ability, any of the disciplines listed in the award, and of course, the relevance of your project to the host country. How will they benefit? How will your collaborators, how will you work with your collaborators in that country, and how will they benefit? And really feed into the whole mission of this, you know, creating mutual understanding and cross-cultural connections through research and teaching. It's also important to consider the level of award in terms of career level, where you are and what it's seeking. So we have several awards that are geared towards postdocs and early career academics, and then we also have some mid-level and then senior awards that are called distinguished chair opportunities. So selecting the right award is really kind of half of the battle. Now, in terms of the application, it's very straightforward. It's nothing you haven't seen before. It's an online application form that we have, and every applicant will be required to submit a 3 to 5 page project statement. So even if you're doing a teaching grant, we want to know, you know, what you propose to teach, why you're proposing these particular courses, how the host institution will benefit, you know, why specifically that host institution in general. And beyond that, the CV or resume needs to be up to 5 pages. For distinguished chairs, it can be up to 8 pages, but the CV page limit is actually 6 pages. I'm sorry, there's a typo there. So the idea is to keep in mind that there are page limits for all of the application materials. And then we do require 3 letters of reference. And you can register the recommenders in our online application system. They will then receive an auto-generated email from our application system. So alert them that they'll be receiving that, because some university email servers have very, very strong spam filters. And so if it's an auto-generated email, it might land up in their junk folder. So be aware that that could happen, and let them know that it's coming their way. If they didn't receive it in their inbox, you can go back into the application and send a reminder. You can also change your recommenders at any time. If one person says, actually, I'm not going to be able to get it to you in time, you can delete their name and add a new name. Again, we only want 3 letters of recommendation. If you submit 4, we will write to you after the deadline and ask you which one we should delete. And then, of course, depending on what you plan to do and what the award requires, you will need a bibliography if you're doing a research project. If you're combining that with teaching or doing a teaching project on it by itself, you will need 2 to 3 syllabi, totaling no more than 10 pages. Bibliography is 3 pages. And then, of course, depending on the requirements of the award, if a letter of invitation is required or strongly preferred, we do suggest you get that in as soon as possible. Make contacts now. You have plenty of time to get the letter in by the deadline. And if it's required, the language proficiency report, which is an external evaluation of your language abilities, and that can be uploaded just like a letter of recommendation. You would submit the person's, the evaluator's name and email. They would get the report and do the evaluation for you. And ideally, the person who would complete the language proficiency report would be someone who teaches the language at the university level. All right, so moving on, I'm going to let Carlene take over the next few slides.
Okay, so many people ask about affiliations and invitations for the award. Just so that you know, not every award requires an invitation, so you want to carefully look at the program requirements to see whether your institution requires an invitation letter or not. In certain awards, the host institution is actually identified, and that can be found in the location in the awards catalog. It's really important, if you are applying to an award that has a specific institution affiliated with it, that you understand the research and teaching goals of that institution so that you can see whether you're a good fit for that institution. When a host is not identified, then there are several resources to find an affiliation. The first resource that you can consider is the international office on your campus. They may be able to introduce you to scholars from that country who actually work on your campus, and they would be able to reach into their network and help you find a connection at a university in the country you're applying to. The next resource, and I think this one is really a very valuable resource, is the U.S. and Visiting Fulbright Scholar Directory, and you can find that on the CIES website. In that directory, you can search for visiting scholars or U.S. core scholars. In that program, you can search by discipline, you can search by country, and the people in the alumni network are often very understanding if you have questions about the home university, and to the extent that they can, they're willing to give you some ideas and suggestions or maybe even an introduction. Also in the awards, if you look under the award description, they have some suggested contacts there. And so if there is a contact in the award description, I would recommend going and starting with that contact, since they've been approved as contact for that particular award. Now, if you do receive a letter of invitation from a university, I just want to make sure that you guys are agree or you understand that it is a non-binding expression of interest from the university who is proposing to host you. And there will be times when a university will issue multiple invitation letters to multiple people. It does not guarantee that you will receive an award, and it doesn't guarantee that you won't receive an award if multiple people get them. It is just stating an interest that you guys mutually have in the research that you would conduct if you were granted an award. The invitation should come from the person with whom you will be collaborating, so it is ideal to identify that person and have them write the letter on your behalf. And what I do want to make sure you guys keep in mind is that it should be on the host institution's letterhead so that they could tell it's an official invitation from that university. Okay, so overall, to submit a competitive application, it is very important that you address the Fulbright goal of promoting mutual understanding. Above and beyond, this is an exchange program, and when we can do it to conduct scholarly endeavors, it also increases the mutual understanding that we have with the other countries. You want to express why you are interested in a Fulbright award in your proposed country. So why does your award research need to be done in that particular country? It's also helpful when you are submitting a competitive application that you talk about your professional expertise and skills and how it can benefit the host institution. Remember, the Fulbright, above and beyond anything, wants to promote mutual understanding, so they want to see some give and take between you and your host institution and how you can actually contribute as well. That leads into the whole idea that this is a cultural diplomacy activity, and as such, it's really helpful that you can demonstrate some type of flexibility or adaptability, because as much as we try to have everything organized ahead of time, certain things change in certain countries due to political situations and whatnot. So we do ask that you be flexible as we try to come up with the best outcome for everyone. And then the final thing with submitting a competitive application is just that you want to keep in mind the outcomes, the impact, and what we call the multiplier effect. So how does this help your professional development? How will it impact your home campus, the students, right, your profession? When you are abroad, can you create future collaborations? Can you interact with professional or institutional partners over in that country that might continue beyond? And also one thing to keep in mind is how can your experience help internationalize your campus and your curriculum? So above all, we want to see the impact last beyond your Fulbright year and go into your professional work. Okay, so just to keep in mind the timeline, as you all know at this advising section, we do have a deadline approaching. The deadline is September 16th. After that, we will have a technical review of all of the applications from November to December. Excuse me. Okay, and then in December, the U.S. embassies and the Fulbright commissions will review the recommended applicants that they receive. And the host countries, the governments, the ministries, whoever is responsible for administering the program in the country to which you're applying will receive the application materials. And at that point, they will recommend applications to be reviewed by the J. William Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board for approval. Once they are approved, you will receive a letter notifying you of the results. And following that, the U.S. Embassy host ministry placement negotiations will begin. And so we have a lot of work that we have to do on the ground to prepare for the scholarship. And then from May on, you would prepare for your departure. Departures take place between July 2020 and May 2021. And the departures and the pre-departure orientations take place all over the United States. So there's a wide variety in where they do take place. Now that you guys have heard some of our tips and best practices for making a competitive application, let's move on to some of the questions that you have.
Okay, great. So let's take a look at what we've received so far, and thank you for sending your questions. So one we have is, I have just learned that my host department will be hosting a Fulbright specialist this spring. Will this hurt my chances to become a U.S. scholar to the same institution and department for the cycle? No, actually the programs are completely separate. So whether or not your university will have a specialist, that's again just a 2 to 6 week engagement. And typically the scholar awards are at least 3 to 5 months, so the full semester. And typically projects that are 3 to 5 months in nature are much different than a two week or 1 month project. So you should be absolutely fine. And again, this spring would be a completely different cycle. So what we're looking for, the awards that we're recruiting for now for the September deadline are for the following academic year. So you should be fine. All right, so let's see. Questions are coming in so quickly. All right, If we are a recent college graduate and the student program is a better fit, will the information in this webinar still be applicable? The programs are rather different, so I would recommend tuning into one of the webinars that the student program hosts. They do a lot of webinars, and because the application components are different and the timelines are different, so this might not be the best use of your time if you're looking at the student program. All right. When does the IRB, this is a good question, it's been coming up a lot. When does the IRB for human subjects need to be completed? Does it need to be completed at the time of submission or at the time the grant begins, should I be selected? So that's great. So we need to ensure that you have it once the grant begins. So if you are in the process right now, or we'll start that process once you're notified, if you're selected, that's fine. You do not need to have it at the time of application.
Okay, Michelle, here's another question. Is it appropriate to have a former student write a letter of recommendation for a teaching award?
The answer would be no. We need colleagues and those that supervise your teaching, so your chair or whoever is responsible for observing and can speak about your teaching. So no recommendations from students, please.
Okay, one more recommendation letter question is, do the letters have to be in by the September 16th deadline, or does it suffice that we provide the names of the referees and they have more time to enter their letters?
Yeah, so we begin reviewing applications the morning of the 17th. So if your application is incomplete in that it does not have any of the letters of recommendation, we will be reaching out to you and your application will not be going forward until we do. So that being said, I would encourage you to have your recommenders submit by the deadline. If they need a couple extra days, please let us know and we can, you know, grant that on a case-by-case basis. Some awards are so competitive, though, that if we do not have complete applications at the time of the peer review, you will not be a competitive applicant.
Okay, continuing on with letter of recommendations, one of the references went silent after they agreed to write a letter, and it says, I am concerned with the deadline drawing near. He has not responded to the reminder emails. What should I do? So if a recommender is not responding and we're getting close to the deadline, what should an applicant do?
So if possible, I would give that person a call and see if they're still able to commit to submitting it by the deadline. And if not, you are welcome to go back into the application and delete that person's name and enter a new colleague, new colleague's contact information so that that person can get it started. So you're certainly eligible, able to go into the application and move things around, change things. And you can always see where you are with your recommenders. Once you log into your application, if you click on the recommendation and language evaluator section of the application, you will see if the email was sent to them, what date it was sent to them. You'll see if they started working on it. It'll say in progress as of, and then the date. So you'll be able to see exactly where you stand with your letters of recommendation.
Okay, here's a specific question. I met with individuals from my host university. I am applying for a research and teaching opportunity. Due to strict requirements by the government, I am only allowed to co-teach. When I met with professors, we discussed which courses I would be providing the most value. I was provided course syllabi in the invitation letter. Is co-teaching allowed as an academic activity?
Sure. So co-teaching is allowed, but the syllabi that the host has given you, you should not submit as your own syllabi. What we need to see are, you know, the syllabi is part of your application and indicates your teaching style and the resources and the books that you draw upon to teach the course. So we would like to see at least one course outline or syllabus from a course that you've done in the past, and then perhaps one that's tailored for what you're going to be doing on the grant.
Okay, thank you, Michelle. We have one other question here. Can you say more about how best to show alignment with the Fulbright goals? Are there also goals for specific regions that we need to address in our statement?
So you really only need to talk about the goals for the country in terms of the regional part of that question, but in terms of the goals for the overall program, really kind of indicating that you are interested in the program and serving as a cultural ambassador. This really is kind of citizen diplomacy at its best, and so that needs to be discussed in your project statement, how you're flexible, how you're adaptable, why you're interested in participating in Fulbright and being part of this network. And so speaking to kind of your interest, your adaptability, all of those things, and how you hope to collaborate in country with your hosts and with your peers there, and how that'll extend beyond your Fulbright grant.
Thank you so much. Here's a question. I lived abroad from February 2008 to August 2014. The experience abroad section in the application asks us to add experience abroad in months. Should I list the start date as 2018 or 2013 to only capture the months within the 6-year period?
Right, so that's a good question. Ultimately, I mean, the point of that question is really to determine if you're eligible. So we need to see, you need to demonstrate eligibility by indicating the length of time you've been abroad in the 6 previous years to the application. So we're only looking at the 6 previous years, and in order to be eligible, no more than 5 years can, in other words, less than 5 years needs to have been abroad, can be resident abroad. So make sure that that's clear in your reply. So since it's been, for you, it's been more than a few months, you can list the year in full. And again, keep in mind, an academic year, or if you've been abroad for 9 months out of a calendar year, we count that as a full calendar year away.
Thank you, Michelle. I have one other question about a host institution. I do not have a host institution determined yet. Is that okay?
That should be fine. We're hearing that a lot of people who are applying to awards in Europe, for example, are not getting replies yet because the offices at the universities there are closed still. So you're not the only one who either hasn't determined a host or hasn't heard from the host. What I would do now at this point is to really determine where you might be a good fit. So if you're not sure where to start, start with the scholar directory and see where scholars to and from that country. So let's say if you're applying to Vietnam, you can go into our Fulbright Scholar Directory, and we can actually show that to you as well. You can go into the Fulbright Scholar Directory and type in Vietnam as the program country and click search, and you'll find both American grantees and Vietnamese grantees who've participated in the program and see, you know, if there's anybody that you can reach out to. We certainly do encourage you to contact alumni. They can maybe introduce you to the host. They can provide useful information, things like that. If you're having trouble getting replies there, certainly reach out to us, and we can ask the Fulbright commissions or the embassies, our colleagues abroad, for their suggestions.
Okay, thank you, Michelle. I have another question. What are obligations for the host institution, especially the financial obligations?
So there really aren't any obligations from the host beyond, you know, it really depends. If it's a partner award, so if you're applying to, let's say, Australia's, you know, RMIT award in entrepreneurship, that university is already partnered with Fulbright in funding that award, so that obligation is already taken care of. If they would like to provide you an office space and, you know, access to the lab or the library or whatever it is you need, of course, that's kind of understood that they would be willing to do that. There's no financial cost up front to the host, though.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm going to take the next question here, which is that I just learned about the Fulbright program. Since the deadline is approaching, is it too late to look for host institutions? My answer to that is to understand that each award is slightly different, and some awards actually request that you do not seek a letter of invitation. So therefore, with the 4 weeks that you have left, or just under 4 weeks now, you could still put together a competitive application, but you might want to try to look at awards that do not require letters of invitation. And above all, you want to look at the awards that are a good match for your professional profile, where you are in your career, what your research is, and what some of the preferred areas of specialization are for that country. But in the awards catalog, you can actually search by letter of invitation and select countries where they are either not to be sought or they are optional. If you have a question about fit too, you are welcome to reach out to any of the Fulbright program advisors on the South and Central Asia team or the East Asia and the Pacific team. Okay, here's a question for you, Michelle. For my proposed research at the host university, I'm looking specifically to work with an expert in my field there, although I will be working with data from the U.S. Is the later a problem or a point against my proposal?
That's a good question. So you will be able to speak about collaborating with your peers at the host in the host country. But what kind of research will you be undertaking? So we need to see, you know, there needs to be a justification for the in-country residence. That's what the peer reviewers are going to be looking at. Why do you need to go to that country if the data and the research has already been done and you have it in the U.S.? It's, of course, nice to have an opportunity to meet with your collaborators abroad, but we need to see that you're making best use of the time and justify funding for your proposed project. So if the project is merely just working together and writing up the research so that it can be published as an article, that will not be funded. You need to undertake research in that country, and you need to outline what specifically will be done, you know, and give provide a timeline. Great. Any other questions? It looks like we still have some more coming in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the next one has to do with images. So images with descriptive notes are preferred over PowerPoint presentations. And there's a quote, you must provide relevant and appropriate details for each work, including titles, nature, dimension, authorships, and dates and execution or production of each work. Can applicants provide a separate list, or should the words appear on each JPEG image file itself? If submitting a separate file, does it take the place of one of the 10 images? Or can 10 image files plus one text description file be uploaded?
So that should be fine, but if you're able to label each of the images with a caption or in the, you know, the title of the image, that would be fine too. But certainly the captions on a separate sheet would not be counted as an image. So.
Okay. If my award doesn't require a letter of invitation, does it require an affiliation? If I am open to placement as determined by the committee, do I still need to seek an affiliation?
No. So the letters of invitation are for an affiliation, so it's kind of one and the same thing. If you are applying to an award that states that the letter of invitation is optional and you are not able, you know, you haven't been to that country before, you don't really know where you would be a good fit, you can certainly let the commission or the embassy determine that if it states that that's something that they would do. But oftentimes it helps if you do a little research to determine where you might be a good fit and state that in the project statement so that the committee abroad can understand where you think you would be a good fit. And certainly, so for example, in the case of India, this is true. You don't need a letter of invitation, and ultimately the commission will determine final placements, but it certainly helps if you identify a potential host or hosts. So I would say, you know, if you're spending all this time putting an application together, it would behoove you to do a little research as to where you may be the best fit. Again, reaching out to contacts in the scholar directory, contacting program staff. We're happy to help you with that.
Okay, thank you, Michelle. I have a couple questions that have come up about notification. So will we be notified at each stage of the review process or simply get one notification at the end?
So actually we can go, Carlene, let's go to our web page and we can show you the timeline. So you will be notified after the peer review process. And let's go to the home page. Yeah. And you can see the full timeline when you click on programs. And then when you click again on U.S. Scholar. And then you'll see one of the tabs here is timeline. And so you'll be notified after the peer review, and then the final notifications will go out after the in-country review. And so you can see here a month-by-month detail of how that works.
Thank you, Michelle.
Oh, and we have a question about getting a copy of these slides. I want to let everybody know that we are recording this session and it will be archived on our website. We'll try and do that as soon as possible, but look next week and you'll be able to see that. But there certainly are other virtual advising sessions that have already been held for the other regions. So if you go onto our webinar archive, you can find past virtual advising sessions, and they essentially have all the same slides, but the questions are different.
Okay. Now we have a question about how many classes should I propose to teach? Will I teach all or do they select?
Okay, so that really depends. If you're just doing a teaching grant, it might stipulate in the award description how many classes are expected. It actually varies from country to country. For some, two is a full load. For others, it's four. And then, of course, it can be anything in between if you're doing a teaching and research combination. So that really needs to be determined with the host institution. If you're not able to reach out to the host institution because a letter should not be sought or you're not getting any feedback from the host, I would, you know, put forward what you think is reasonable for your time based on how long you'll be there and what you'll be doing if you're also doing research as well. And you can also propose, hey, look, I can teach, these are my four classes that I would be, expert to teach in, that I'd be very comfortable teaching. So any of these four, you know, I could teach. So kind of proposing more than just letting the host and the commission know where you could be placed based on need.
Right, because ultimately you will be conducting a teaching load appropriate for the grant, whether it's full-time or part-time teaching research, and so they might ask you also whether you want to teach X or Y based on your list, or they might ask you if you're capable of teaching something that meets their needs. Okay, can you please talk, Michelle, about the process after peer review?
Okay, sure. So let's go take a look at this the timeline that we've got here. And after the peer review, the applications that are recommended for final review are then sent to the host country. So if you're applying to India or if you're applying to Vietnam, for example, The commission in India would review the application, or the embassy in Vietnam would review the application. And that team is made up of people from all different backgrounds in academia, professional backgrounds, and then, of course, the binational colleagues there at the embassy and the commission. So it's Americans as well as peers in that country. And so they'll be reviewing the application, and they make the final decision. So it's important for your project statement, and this goes back to how you can create put forward a competitive project statement, is really speaking to your peers who are reviewing the application in your discipline, so the discipline reviewers, and then also speaking to non-specialists, people from different backgrounds and disciplines that might not understand. If they're in the arts and you're proposing something in STEM, that's important to be able to speak broadly about the importance of your program and what you plan to do.
And one other thing to keep in mind is in the award description, if they have preferred disciplines, then sometimes targeting those can also help you meet their specific needs a little bit better. Although in a lot of the all disciplines awards, they are open to receiving competitive or compelling applications in any field.
Yeah, just keep in mind the disciplines that are listed as preferred, or even the specializations that are listed as preferred, are essentially just kind of a wish list from that country. It's by no means, if it's an all disciplines award, it doesn't mean that others outside of that list are ineligible. So we encourage all disciplines for those awards.
Okay, so someone said that we skipped the slide about the project statement. Can we go back to that?
Sure.
I will return to that slide here. Okay, I apologize about skipping that. I'll take a minute to review that slide with you. When you are writing your project statement, it's important that you state the skills, knowledge, and experience that you have and how it will help your host country and institution. Again, we want you to keep in mind the fact that this is a two-way exchange, so you really want to look at the interplay between what you can offer and what your host institution can also receive from the scholarship that they share with you. Another thing to keep in mind is that you want to tell a story. What led you to apply for this fellowship? It is important that you have the intercultural factor present in your story, because as opposed to a grant, say, for example, NSF, that is purely for academic research, this is academic and it is also intercultural exchange. So you want to make sure that you tell your story about how that is going to play a role in your work. You want to take some time to highlight the outcome of the grant. How is it going to help your host institution, your employer, you? What plans do you have after you return to keep some of this information alive in your own teaching? How adaptable are you? That's really important, because flexibility is key in many of these situations. How do you deal with challenging situations? If you get to a country and suddenly you have to change a host institution, would you be prepared to deal with that? So just talking about the flexibility is really useful. And then finally, laying out your proposed research project in as much detail as you can. But I do want to have a caveat to that. You want to provide detail, but as Michelle was saying, your work is going to be reviewed by peer reviewers and then also people in the country. And so you want to make sure you're writing to both of those audiences. When you propose your research, it is best if you can do it in text only. We really discourage the use of graphics and images. We prefer that you actually explain your work and make sure that, again, you come back to that cultural component of why this interaction with another country will help you with the project statement. So I apologize for going past that one. Thank you. Okay, Michelle, I have a question for you. The application asks about accompanying dependents. What is the best advice about listing dependents if we're not 100% certain that they are able to accompany us because of employment or school?
So again, it's just the application at this point. So if you anticipate that they would be coming with you, please do list them. Of course, once you get the grant, you will be required to confirm and, you know, have all the final details ironed out. But in the application, I mean, it's essentially a proposal. So if you anticipate your dependents accompanying you on the grant for at least 80% of the time, that's what qualifies as a dependent, then please do list their names. But again, we will confirm all of that should you be offered the grant.
Okay. Is there a greater or lesser likelihood of receiving a flex award versus a full year award?
So the flex option is only available for some awards. And if a country has, let's say, 10 grants for an award, maybe they'll do half flex, or maybe they'll earmark two or three for flex. So it's got to be a project that really requires more than one visit to the host country. So a project that is linear in nature where you're going to collect data. And again, for most of the flex options, it's only research that's available for that. The teaching grants are usually not flex. So, you know, if you're collecting data and then a year later you need to go back and follow up and, you know, collect more data, that makes sense if you're tracking things. But if it's just to suit your personal schedule, that would not be a compelling reason to fund a flex project. So just keep that in mind. We've added flex in the past few years. It is a new kind of innovation to the program, but certainly the project needs to warrant multiple visits.
Thank you, Michelle. Here's another question. Are there any research topics that are not advisable? For example, I'm doing research that may be in a sensitive area in regards to my proposed host country.
Great. So that's a good question. We do get those questions quite a bit. And I would just say use your good judgment and common sense considering the committees that will be reviewing this. So after the discipline review with your, you know, peer reviewers, these applications are then reviewed by the binational commissions or the U.S. Embassy in that country. And so certainly you want to be aware that they would like to fund projects that really promote the mission of the program, which is promoting mutual understanding, enhancing cross-cultural connections and collaborations. And so you wouldn't want to propose something that would be taken badly by the host country. Again, keep in mind that the vast majority of these opportunities are co-funded by our partners abroad. And so they are really excited and interested in bringing American scholars to their host countries, to their home institutions there, all of that. And so countries like India, countries like Germany, they're putting up at least 50% of the funding for this program, and so they really want to bring the best and brightest scholars and projects to their countries and enhance the classroom experience for their students, enhance the research opportunities for their scholars. And so keep in mind the purpose of the program and kind of use your judgment when dealing with sensitive topics.
Thank you, Michelle. Here's a question that we get often in our inboxes as well, and it's a really great question. While my discipline is not listed as preferred in the host country, however, the subject of my research project falls under the government's initiative and interest, is it considered a strong match?
So I would say, again, if it's an award that is open to other disciplines that are listed in the award, so if it's an all disciplines award, but they said, well, you know, the preferred disciplines are American literature, history, and political science, and you're not in that. You're maybe from sociology or from public health. But if you have a very compelling project that's relevant to the host country, you would certainly be a competitive applicant. So again, keep in mind that that list of preferred disciplines does not exclude other disciplines from applying.
Thank you very much. I have another question. For the lecturer award, are the lecturers considered employees of the host institution?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think it would be how you would have a visiting faculty. I think that's how a lot of our Fulbrighters are in, treated in terms of their status at the host institutions. So it's you're, by no means you're not an employer. You're still with your home institution, but you're kind of on a fellowship at that institution. So again, depending on the country and depending on the visa and all those different kind of requirements, there might be variation in this, but certainly you would not be an employer because the funding you receive goes directly to your bank account from the Fulbright program.
Okay, thank you, Michelle. I have some question here about the journalism grant in Japan. Have they had anyone receive this award recently?
Oh, yes. If you go on the Japan Commission, or you can even search on our Fulbright Scholar Directory, you can find grantees in journalism that have gone to Japan. You can also search the Fulbright Commission in Japan's website and get the full list of past grantees for all kinds of awards, and the journalism award is specified.
Okay, thank you. I have a question now from a professional musician who is applying to do research in India. Is there anything specific that this applicant should know about applying to the Fulbright Nehru Award?
Okay, so it's important that, again, since the letter of invitation is optional, you should at least identify a host institution. So I spoke to somebody earlier today who is interested in going to a country to do research for a book that they plan to write, but the only contacts they have are not affiliated with any particular institution. So it's really important that although you might be working and collaborating with other musicians in that country, please do identify a host institution, because again, this is not only a people-to-people opportunity, it's also institution-to-institution. So, or in this case, if you're an independent musician, you know, what institution will you be affiliating with in India?
Okay, thank you. I have a question about, I propose two-thirds teaching and one-third research. The research will be doing field research to write a case and its teaching notes. I'm assuming this is for a business award. Do I need to explain how cases are written? For example, that the bibliography for a case comes after the research, not before.
Okay, so the research will be doing to write a case of teaching that. Do I need to explain? So first of all, the bibliography for the purposes of the application is simply kind of more of a literature review. So whatever sources and materials you'll be using that you've used to reference in your project statement, all of those things and kind of the latest, most relevant publications or materials related to your research need to be listed in the bibliography. So I'm not quite sure what the question is in terms of the bibliography, but you don't really need to explain. Let's see, do I need to explain how cases are written? I don't think that's required. I think you really need to focus on what. If you're doing two-thirds teaching, the bulk of your time is going to be spent on teaching. Tell us why you're proposing those courses, how the host will benefit, and for the one-third teaching portion, what you hope to do, and provide the timeline.
Okay, thank you. Another question is about the language evaluator. Does the language evaluator need to have a specific template in mind before evaluating our language skills?
So once you register your language evaluator, that person will receive an email with all of the questions that need to be asked. And so the template is essentially that email. So once they start that, they'll be able to go through and kind of just check through and give us comments about your fluency in terms of reading, writing, and speaking.
Okay, thank you very much, Michelle. Here's another question about reference letters. If I'm reapplying, can I use the same reference letters from last year's submission? Meaning, does the online system keep them, or will I need new letters?
So every year we require applicants to submit a brand new application, even if they've applied in the previous year. And this is even more important because this year we have a brand new application system. So we don't keep anything on file from previous years in our system, and so you will need to have everything fresh and updated for the application.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle. Can I start an application for the recommenders to use and then complete other application documents later?
Yes, but you will need, I believe, you will need to at least select the award, and if not, maybe at least the grant activity, because, if you're just registering your recommenders, you can certainly just start the application and register them. If you want to add any documents like your CV or your bibliography, all of that, the application first requires you to select an award. Because then, of course, if it's a teaching award, they'll only prompt you for the syllabi. If it's a research award, they'll only prompt you for the biblio. So certainly, if you're just going in to register the recommenders, that's fine.
Okay, I have a question about the application itself. The application asks about alternative awards or countries we would be interested in should we not receive the exact award we apply for. How often or likely is it that we might be considered for an alternative award? How does that process work?
So it happens on some occasions where, and again, it's very helpful. So as a general guideline, we always do mention, please do indicate countries or awards, other countries and awards of interest. Don't discuss them in your project statement, but there is an opportunity to list, I believe, up to three in the application. And this comes in handy when, let's say, because of course every year we receive many more qualified applications than we have spots for. And specifically, if you're applying, let's say, to Australia and your field is environmental sciences, but there's only one grant for that Australian award, but you also list, well, I'd also be interested in Uzbekistan, okay? So, and Uzbekistan that year, let's say, doesn't get any environmental scientists, and they'd really like to have somebody in environmental sciences. They might ask us to say, well, were there any top applications in environmental sciences that expressed interest in Uzbekistan? And we can pull that information from your application. So it's very helpful to have. So on some occasions, we'll say, look, we know you have proposed a project in one country, but would you be interested going over here? So that sometimes happens, so it's important to fill that out.
Thank you, Michelle. I have a question about eligibility. Are senior level applicants eligible only for Distinguished Chair Awards?
Oh, that's a good question. No, you are not compelled to apply just for the Chair Awards. Certainly we want to offer those in the catalog. For scholars who would like more of a senior position at the host institution. But for example, if I take the case of India, India has the All Disciplines Academic and Professional Excellence Award, which is open to teaching and research or a combination, whereas the Chair Award is only open to teaching or teaching and research. So if you're a senior scholar that wants to go to India to do research, by default, you can't apply for the Chair Award, even if you qualify, simply because the Chair Award does not allow for 100% research projects.
Thank you, Michelle. I have another question right here from an applicant who's been working on an application since May. This person says, I'm applying for a teaching award, and I've hit two roadblocks. One is obtaining a letter of invitation. I've tried all the suggestions already. People don't even bother to reply to my inquiries. What do you recommend? And also for the teaching award, I can obtain letters of recommendation from my chairperson and other professors. But the recommendation letter that comes from someone who knows you at another university is a challenge.
So for a teaching grant, you are not required to submit a letter of recommendation from someone outside of your home institution. We suggest it if you like, but you can have all three letters come from your home institution. That's absolutely fine. And as to your first question about the roadblocks and getting any contacts for the letter of invitation, please do write to us. That's what we're here for, and we can assist with that.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have only 3 more minutes left, and we have many more questions.
Goodness, the time's just flying.
I do want to let people know that the session will be recorded. It has been recorded, and it will be uploaded to our website, so you can go back and listen there. Okay, the next question that I have is about competitiveness. How can we evaluate the competitiveness of an award? Can you give any indicators on how to evaluate this?
So it actually might change year to year, so it's best to contact us and speak to us and see how it's going. Some awards are very popular one year, and then sometimes we see awards that don't get any applications. So it does change, and of course the award offerings do change from year to year. So something that was very popular one year might not be offered this year. So then interest kind of funnels to other awards. So give us a call, send us an email, and we'd be happy to advise you.
Okay. Here's one other question from an emeritus professor. It's unlikely my experience can have much effect on my former institution since I no longer have any interaction with students. Is this a problem when applying for the awards?
So, of course, we do ask that you speak about the outcomes, the outcomes of your grant, whether it's bringing it back to the classroom and whatnot. So if you're no longer with an institution, do you plan on publishing, or how will you promote, this opportunity beyond the experience you had in country? Will you give talks or lectures at your home institution? Will you write about it in the newspaper? We'd like to see that the Fulbright kind of experience continues after the grant itself.
Thank you very much, Michelle. It looks like we're out of time, but we have many more excellent questions. So I'd like to encourage you to reach out to Michelle or myself. You can find our email addresses in the award description that you are applying for, and we would be happy to answer your questions directly or set up a consultation if you would like to talk further about what it is you are considering or questions that you have about your specific awards. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we leave today, Michelle?
Well, I think we've hit on a lot of great things today. For those of you that are applying in the arts or architecture, journalism, and creative writing, please note that there's also a portfolio that's required if your project is related to those, and that information is also found on our website. Again, Carlene and I are here to help, so for those of you whose questions were not answered, please follow up with an email, and we'd be happy to get back to you.
All right. Thank you very much, and hopefully we will see your application in our application pool soon. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.